toward the file. "Is that Sancho?"
"Yep. What do you think?"
She shrugged. "I think that if he's got a pulse and a pecker, we put him on patrol." She continued to look at me. "What are you going to do about dinner?"
"I don't know. Maybe go down to the bee." The busy bee was in a small concrete block building that clung to the banks of Clear Creek through the tenacity of its owner and the strength of its biscuits and spice gravy. Dorothy Caldwell had owned and operated the bee since Christ had been a cowboy. I ate there frequently, and due to its proximity to the jail, so had our infrequent lodgers.
"I bet she's gone home."
"I'll take my chances. If worst comes to worst, I can always catch the pepper steak over at the Home for Assisted Living." She made a face.
"That sounds appealing."
"Better than a plastic-wrapped burrito from the come-and-go."
"Boy, you know all the hot spots, don't you?"
"I have been known to show a girl a good time, yes." After Vic and Ruby had gone, the beast ambled in and sat on my foot. I was second string, but it was still good to be on the team. She was probably right. With the impending storm, Dorothy had most likely headed home for the night. I weighed my options and settled on a chicken pot pie from the jail's resources. Dog followed me as I rummaged through the mini refrigerator and pulled out the freeze du jour. We didn't have any occupants, so I took my steaming little tin into holding cell one and sat down on the bunk with a can of iced tea. Dog curled up at the door and looked at me. I had taught him that begging was all right if it was done from at least 6 feet away. There were no windows, so I could ignore the mounting snow outside, but the phone that began ringing I could not. I set my half-eaten chicken pot pie tin on the bunk and answered the extension on the wall of our kitchenette. "Absaroka County Sheriff's Department."
"Is this the goddamn sheriff?"
I recognized the voice. "Maybe."
"Well, if you ain't him, then somebody better go out and find the simple-minded son of a bitch and tell him to get his ass over here. I ain't got all night."
The phone went dead with a loud crack as the cradle on the other end absorbed the impact, and I stood there listening as my pot pie was devoured. I had talked Lucian into coming on as a part-time dispatcher on weekends, and I think he enjoyed it, but I would be the last one he would tell. He drove the rest of the staff crazy, but Dog liked him, and so did I. I took the pie tin and threw it into the trash along with the plastic spork and my empty tea. I headed for the office to grab my coat. Dog followed. Vic was right. By the time we got outside, it was snowing so hard that you couldn't see across the street to the courthouse. I squinted against the sting, tugged at my hat, and took in the vague halos of the arch lights that ran the distance of Main Street. There was only one car, and it was parked about halfway between the busy bee and the sports shop. The dog halted beside the truck and turned his nose into the wind with me. I opened the door and watched as he climbed across and onto the passenger seat. He turned and looked at me, waiting for me to climb in, but I looked back at the parked car. He stretched across the seat and settled in for a short nap, knowing full well what I was going to do before I did. I walked down the slight grade to the parked vehicle, careful not to slip, stooped down and wiped the snow from the front plate of the maroon Oldsmobile Buick. State plates, County 2, Cheyenne. I looked around at the storefronts, but the only one that showed any signs of retail life was the Euskadi Hotel bar, where the Rainier and Grain Belt beer signs softly glowed in the two tiny windows. Except for the Christmas decorations, the bar at the Euskadi hadn't changed much since Lucian had hired me there all those years ago. The jukebox was still there, playing an unintentionally ironic version of Sinatra's "Let It Snow, Let It Snow, Let It Snow." There was an ornate burl wood bar and bar back along the right side, whose ancient mercury mirror was tarnished and faded in its attempt to hold on to the glory of the age, and it reflected the blonde at the bar. I pushed my hat back to its best to shield Hammett advantage, and felt the slick of melted snow slide down between my shoulder blades and my sheepskin coat. As entrances, I'd made better.
"Hello, Sheriff."
Jerry Aronsati was still the full-time bartender, a small man with a stooped back and black-rimmed glasses, his narrow shoulders hunched as he scooped into the cooler and popped the cap on a reindeer beer before I could stop him. It was at times like this that I wished my habits were a little more exotic. "What brings you out on a night like tonight?" I sat a few stools down as Jerry placed a paper napkin on the bar along with the bottle of beer. He knew all my patterns, even the one about sparing the glassware. "It's chess night." I took a sip of my beer. She didn't look at me, but seemed absorbed in what looked to be an Irish coffee. He gently patted a hand in front of her cup to get her attention. "Miss Watson, this is our sheriff, Walter Longmire." I always try to hold on to the first impression I get of a person. Usually it's a feature, but with her, it was the energy that was there, an animation that couldn't be concealed by age, fatigue, or alcohol. Afterward, I noticed that she was just plain beautiful, with large, frank blue eyes and well-defined lips. "Sheriff, this is Maggie Watson, and I bet you can't guess what she does for a living." "Miss Watson works for the state." I took a sip and looked back at both of them. I really enjoyed watching those big blue eyes widen as they looked at Jerry and then back to me. I guessed mid to late 40s, outdoorsy, and always had been from the face, nicely weathered to perfection. She had an athletic build, probably a skier. The plates in the car outside. "Elementary, my dear." The eyes narrowed. "Bet you wish you had a nickel for every time somebody said that."
"You have no idea."
She had a nice voice, too. It was soft, but also strong, and with just a touch of a southern accent.
"State Treasury Department."
She smiled a sly smile and took an elegant sip of her coffee.
"Unclaimed property project manager."
It was her turn to look self-satisfied. "We don't see many of those up in these parts." I nodded and looked over at Jerry. "Can't say we've seen any at all." It got a laugh that was melodic but short.
"I restore the contents of abandoned safe deposit boxes to the owners or rightful heirs."
She sat her mug down and gave me a sharp look.
"At least I was, till I got stranded."
I thought about it for a moment, then felt duty call and sat the almost full beer back on the bar. "Give me your keys and I'll start it for you. I think we can get you a room if we move quickly. Motels get to be at a premium when the weather gets like this." I tried to pay Jerry, but he just waved me off. Back at my truck, Dog greeted me with a terrific yawn and confirmed my thoughts about his concern for my welfare while I was gone. I cleared the accumulated snow with the windshield wipers and turned on the cautions on the Bullet's light bar. A vague feeling of sadness always came over me in the presence of the lights. Too many seatbelts that were unfastened, too many bald tires. I pulled in front of her car, snagged the long-handled scraper from under the seat, and pushed the majority of the snow off her vehicle onto the covered street. An hour from now, the car would have been a permanent addition to Maine. She came running out and jumped in. She was taller than I thought, or else she just didn't sink into the snow like I did. "Follow me and drive in my tracks, okay?" She nodded, and I closed the door. She dutifully made the illegal U-turn and followed me back up the hill and around the courthouse as we slowly made our way toward the mountains. The red glow of the log cabin motel's neon wasn't far, and if worse came to worse, she could walk to all the banks in town from there. I pulled up to the office and got out, ignoring the no-vacancy sign. I ushered her to the porch and rang the buzzer on the intercom, pulled her in a little closer to the building, and blocked the majority of the wind with my back. She smelled really good. There was no response to the buzzer, so I pressed my thumb against the button and held it there. After a moment, an angry voice screeched at us through the yellowed plastic intercom.
"No vacancy, can't you read?"
There was no more talk, but presently a gaunt individual in a threadbare plaid bathrobe appeared around the counter in the tiny lobby and unlocked the door.
"Jesus, Walt, what are you doing out in this?"
I ushered Maggie in before me. "This lady needs a room." I took the key from Willis's wife, Irma, and trudged off into the snow to turn the lights and heat on in one of the cabins at the end of the short lane. It would be a cozy little place, but as I told her, the temperature wouldn't get above 40 for about 20 minutes.
I don't know how to thank you.
Well, if you come up with any declarations of independence in any of those boxes, it's doubtful.
But I could buy you lunch.
The trip over to the Durant home for assisted living didn't take all that long. Just a couple of blocks of backtracking. When I got there, there was an EMT van waiting at the main entrance. Not a completely novel experience at the place, but still a little unsettling. The doors were closed, but it was still running, and the ember lights made racing yellow ghost wolves that darted across the brick surface. I pushed the doors of the building open, only to be audibly driven back by Fred Waring and the Pennsylvanians singing Ring Those Christmas Bells at an ear-piercing volume. Most of the residents at the home were deaf as fence posts. Dog followed me in. As we went past the Christmas tree behind the abandoned front desk and rounded the hallway leading to room 32, a slight sense of panic began to set in. The door was ajar as we approached, and I quickened my step, but the place was empty. The chess set was out on the folding table, and it looked as though Lucian had already consumed the better part of a tumbler full of bourbon. Dog looked around with me and followed as we quickly made our way out of the room, back down the hallway and again toward the front desk. The Pennsylvanians were still singing as we turned the corner. I caught a glance of the EMT van pulling away, but my attention was drawn to a white-clad attendant. He was being held against the far wall by what I knew to be the strongest grip in the county. I took the direct route behind the counter, which turned out to be something of a mistake, in that my legs got tangled with dog and the hammer of my 45 snagged the lights on the fully decorated tree, lurching it from the wall in a short spark of holiday exuberance. It took both hands and all the weight I could leverage to tug Lucian's hand free from the choking assistant, whom I recognized as Joe Lesky.
"Well, it's about goddamn time!"
He rolled off me against the far wall and pushed himself up with his arms. He glared at Joe, who was massaging his throat and coughing, as Dog, who had escaped unscathed, continued to bark.
"Shut up!"
Dog stopped and went over and sat beside Lucian as if nothing had happened. I was not so forgiving. I pushed the tree off me. "What the hell is going on around here?" It was mostly directed at Lucian, but after a coughing fit, Joe was the first to respond.
"Mr. Connolly was interfering with the transport of a departed client."
He coughed some more and leaned against the opposite wall.
"I want the room behind me sealed up as a crime scene, and I want a full autopsy arranged immediately."
I stared at him as he looked at the battle-weary tree that lay between us.
"Lucian, have you lost your mind?"
It was a bad time for Joe to talk, but he didn't know that.
"Sheriff, I was explaining to Mr. Connolly that we couldn't hold the body of the deceased without the permission of next of kin."
He wouldn't look up from the tree.
"You got it!"
I disconnected the electric light string from my holster and gave the tree one last kick for holly jolly good measure.
"Lucian, you can't."
The dark eyes came up slowly, and the world was swallowed.
"Hold your peace."
He looked old just then. Small, old, and tired, as I had never seen him before. His eyes returned to the deadlights of the tree.
"She was my wife."
Chapter 2 Room 42 at the Durant Home for Assisted Living had been locked off, and the body of Marie Baroja was now waiting for the medical examiner from the Division of Criminal Investigation. In room 32, two old widowers were sitting over a forgotten chessboard and were looking off into the distance in so much of a Dickensian fashion that it could have been an illustration by Phiz. The exposed punt in the 20-year-old bottle of Pappy Van Winkle's Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey sat in the middle of the contained golden sea, tempest in a teapot, lightning in a bottle, or the muse contained. Dog was already asleep on the only sofa he was allowed to sleep on. I kept expecting the thick glass to loosen itself from the bottom of the bottle and float to the surface. Maybe I expected it to sail up through the extended neck and dance about the room. It was, after all, the season for miracles. Maybe that was what I was waiting for, something to jog us loose like the punt in the bottle. Something that would allow me to approach the Black King sitting across the battlefield. A man, up until tonight, I thought I knew. "You have to talk or move, or I'm going to fall asleep." He didn't move. "Fall asleep, Anne." I had opened with the Queen's Indian defense, Petrosian variation, a move I had neither the skill nor the determination to prolong. But Lucian liked to ponder it when I tried. I didn't consciously fall asleep. It's just that the chair was soft and comfortable. The room was dark and warm, and maybe it was the protection of those black eyes that reflected the blinking of the silly lights. Those eyes were not looking into the small darkness outside the double-paned windows. They were looking farther and to a place about which I did not know. There was nothing that would overtake us tonight that those eyes wouldn't see. Nothing that would not deal plainly with a king not in his perfect mind. I must have slept longer than I thought. I didn't remember waking up, and maybe that's what he had intended by starting to tell me the story while I was asleep. I remember hearing his voice, low and steady, coming from some place far away. After the war, her family were Bascos from out on Swayback, four brothers. He paused to take another sip of his bourbon. "My God, you should have seen her. I remember looking over the top of Charlie Floyd's 39 Dodge when she came out on the porch. Her hair was black and thick like a horse's mane." He stopped with the memory. The only other sound in Lucian's apartment was the scorched air heating. His two rooms weren't any different from any of the others in general design, but they had all the style and mass of the Connolly ancestral furnishings. I shifted my weight in the overstuffed horsehair chair and waited. It was summertime, and she had on this little navy blue dress with all the little polka dots. The wind held it against her body. It took him a while to get going again. She was the wildest, most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. Hair, teeth. We sparked that whole summer before her father tried to break it up in the fall. They wanted to send her away to family, keep us from each other. But it was too late. I looked at him, and the night in my head seemed darker. We used to tremble when we touched each other. She had the most beautiful skin I'd ever seen. I would forget from night to night. She wasn't like American girls. She was quiet. She'd speak if spoken to, but only then. Short, soft replies. Basque. There was a part of her that I knew I couldn't get at, ever. It wasn't hostile or intentional, but it was there, like this life apart from us. Maybe she just knew. He stared at the chessboard. The Bascos have an old proverb. A life without friends means death without company. He sighed. We ran off together. Got as far as Miles City and snagged a justice of the peace off his hayfield to come in and marry us. He snorted a short laugh. His wife played the foot pump organ, and he stood there in his rubber shit-caked boots reading the words. He took another sip, and I listened to the ice in his glass. They caught us a little north of there. It was her father and three Basco uncles. He paused again, and I became aware that my eyes were open and he was looking at me. Hell of a rumpus. He reached across and took my hand, rubbing it under his hat along an ancient ridge that ran from the crown of his head to behind his left ear. He let go and resettled his hat.
One of the uncles finally went back and got a tire iron.
That was two run-ins with Basques that I knew about, this one, and the other was some bootleggers where he'd lost his leg.
They sent her away?
He worked at something caught in his teeth, or maybe his jaw still wasn't ready to call that one even.
Annulled us, and married her off.
He placed an elbow on the arm of his tooled leather chair and cupped his chin in his palm.
I'd see her father and them uncles every once in a while in town, even after I was sheriff. They didn't say anything, and I didn't say anything right back.
When did you see her again? It took a while for him to reply, and I had the feeling I was getting in further than he wanted. It didn't matter. When I had sealed room 42 and had the EMTs stow her at Durant Memorial, it had gotten official. He was staring back into the dark reflection of the glass.
About a year ago, a friend of mine said there was a woman over in the far wing who asked about me. New woman. I went over, and it was her.
Must have been quite a shock.
Huh. She had a little house down in Powder Junction. I guess that's where she'd been living.
I edged up in my chair a little. Lucian, why is it I've got her room sealed up and her waiting on a table over at the hospital? His eyes swiveled to mine and stayed there.
All I'm saying is that an absentee husband of a 3-hour marriage that was annulled more than 50 years ago is going to be a hard press as next of kin.
I rubbed my hand across my face, tried to straighten my beard, and continued to look at him.
Lucian, you have to give me something to go on before the children and grandchildren show up and start making my life miserable.
I waited.
You've got to give me something more to work with here.
You don't trust me?
I let it sit there for a while. He wasn't being rational, and it might take a few moments for him to recognize it. I went through the file cards on Lucian's outburst and came up with fear of the unknown and frustration with society and the system mixed with an ingredient I'd never seen in him before. Love. Lucian in love. It was hard to summon up. His eyes shifted back outside, and I could tell a little shame was lurking there.
You have the ME down at DCI to a general. Then you come back here, and we'll talk some more.
When I got back to the front desk, the tree had been placed back in its original spot. It was minus a few ornaments, and I noticed the lights weren't working. Nat King Cole was now singing in German, giving the place an international flavor it sorely needed. I figured Joe Lesky was one of those people that filled the gap of human misery, doing their best to make everybody's lives a little better. About my age, with dark hair and dark eyes, he looked like he might have a touch of Indian, but all the time spent inside must have taken a lot of it out of him. I leaned against the counter, and Dog sat on my foot. I glanced back over at the tree. "How's the patient?" He leaned back in his chair and looked over his shoulder at the abused conifer. Some of the arms looked as if they were signaling aircraft. "I don't think there were any family heirlooms lost, but I still can't get the lights to work." "You don't happen to have the file on Mrs. Barroja?" He slid the folder on the counter toward me. "I had it out for the EMTs."
"No arguments?"
"You're the sheriff."
"That's usually why people argue with me."
With the advent of modern CPR techniques, organ transplants, and life support systems, home field advantage was shifted from the heart and lungs to the brain. In an unprecedented agreement between both lawyers and doctors, the terminal indicator of the Grim Reaper's touch is now the point when all cerebral function has ceased and is deemed irreversible. Brain dead. For Mari Barroja, The bell tolled at exactly 10:43, 12 p.m. Chris Wyatt and Kathy Kent were the attending EMTs. 6 attempts at resuscitation were made, standard for this kind of incident, and a code 99 was radioed to the hospital. Wyatt went for the electric defibrillator paddles, and the woman's body arched 5 more times like a head of rough stock on rodeo weekend. They canceled the code, and they canceled Mari Barocha.
"I'm sorry, Sheriff."
I looked past the file and down at Joe.
"Hmm? Did you know Mrs. Barocha?"
"No." I rubbed my dry eyes. "No, I didn't."
"She's gone on to a far better place."
I nodded. "Did you?"
"Did I?"
"Did you know Mrs. Barocha?"
He thought for a moment. "Not really. I think she was very quiet. Most of the clients are asleep during this shift."
I smiled a little smile, far better places withstanding. "You know Lucian, don't you?" He rubbed his throat and shrugged.
"Everybody knows Mr. Connolly. He's a legend."
I looked back at the file. "I think Mrs. Barocha just might have been a legend, too." I closed the folder and handed it back to him. "Can you make some copies of this for me? It'll save me the official harassment later today."
"Sure."
"Who found her?"
"Jennifer Felsen. Mrs. Barocha must have hit the nurse's button in her room."
"Anybody else visit her last night?"
He was starting off with a folder but stopped to point. "I'm not sure, but you can check the guest register."
I flipped the handcrafted quilted book to where I could read it, scanned the names, and looked for any more Barojas. There was only one. Lana Barocha had signed in at 7:10 and left about an hour later. There were also a couple of Loftons who had gone to room 42 less than 20 minutes before Lana. I could go there and do a little poking around. I looked at Dog, and Dog wagged. I laughed. "Let's go get the butler that did this." It honestly didn't look like a murder case. It looked like a lonely room where a vibrant and beautiful woman had been warehoused to finish up her days. There's no allowance for murder, no curve in which we judge the value of human life on a chronological sliding scale, no matter how I had teased Lucian. I owed Mari Barocha. I'd never met the woman, but she was from Absaroka County, and she was mine. There was a crucifix above the bed, which was the only decoration on the walls. There were a few personal items and a quilt, a Bible, and a few letters from some law firm in Miami. I figured I'd get to the letters later. There were 7 photographs, all in antique silver frames. Some of the pictures were so aged that their emulsion had adhered to the inside surface of the glass. The oldest looked to be one of what I was willing to bet were the 4 short brothers, all on short horses. They were thin and hard-looking men, and I'm sure the wind whistled when it cut around them. They appeared as if they were carved out of ironwood. I thought about that fight north of Miles City, and was glad I wasn't there for that particular apocalypse. The next was of a man, I believe the 4th horseman on the end, along with a woman whom I assumed was his wife. They looked dour and righteous, so I moved on. The next photo was that strange color that only seemed to exist in the 50s, like real color wasn't good enough. There were 2 small girls in summer dresses and berets, seated on a doorstep. They looked happy, but like they had to be. They both had long, dark hair, and the one on the right was looking off to the right. The next was a young Air Force officer, circa mid-60s, who looked vaguely familiar. He was a lieutenant and battle-awarded, with a green and yellow ribbon bar that told me it was Vietnam. There was a sad quality to the photo, and he didn't seem to fit with all the others. He was blonder, and the eyes just looked different. The next set of photos was lying on the floor, amid a pile of prescription medicines and a hard-bound copy of Pride and Prejudice. I opened a reader-worn Bible and found a handwritten note in Basque that read, "Aver nire aitaran echea, defendituco dut ocho en contra." I kneeled by a partially wrapped dish of what looked and smelled like almond cookies. I was hungry and was tempted to tamper with the evidence, but instead picked up the next framed photograph. It was a group shot of the Barogia family. The vantage point of the camera and the distance made it hard to pick out the individuals, but the brothers were there with their wives and a priest. I thought I could make out the two little girls, having grown and acquired husbands, but the lieutenant wasn't there. The last was the most recent and was of a woman in maybe her late 20s, who looked embarrassed in a chef's jacket and hat. It was the only one that had official printing along the bottom, which read, Culinary Institute du Basque, Bayonne, France. She had short wisps of jet-black hair that were pulled back and behind the ears, revealing wide-set dark eyes steeped in facetious sarcasm. I liked her already, which was good because when I turned, she was standing by the door. It was a simple statement.
She's dead.
I stood and looked at Dog, who was looking at her. Some guard dog. When I looked at her again, she was looking at the carpeted floor down and to the left. I took a step toward her, but her eyes didn't move. I went ahead with my educated guess. Ms. Barogia? Lana Barogia? She hadn't changed much since the cooking school photo. Thinner. Maybe a little more tired-looking. She had on a full-length quilted coat that was just shy of purple and a red stocking cap that matched neither the scarf at her neck nor the gloves on her hands. She wore high-top waterproof boots, and I was thinking it was a good thing she could cook because the career in high fashion wasn't working out. I looked at her again and felt bad about the judgments I was levying on someone who had lost someone very dear. I'm Sheriff Walt Longmire, and I'm very sorry. I've got Mrs. Barogia over at Memorial.
You've got her?
It was just a turn of phrase, unless you were listening for it. Yes.
Can I see her?
Here we go. There are just a few formalities we need to take care of concerning the late Mrs. Barogia.
Formalities?
I'm afraid that your grandmother's death was specifically unattended with a declaration of death registered by the emergency medical technician, but we're going to need a formal certificate from the attending physician indicating that the death was due to natural causes, secondary to old age. I thought it sounded like I knew what I was talking about.
Or?